of the 14th century, the Plantagenets have ruled England for almost 200 years. 8 kings, starting with Henry II, and now, in 1399, the direct line ends with Richard II. But now, the dynasty, although still Plantagenet, is to splinter. First, the House of Lancaster, then the House of York, each tracing its line to the original Plantagenet monarch, Henry II. For the next 60 or so years, England will be ruled by the House of Lancaster, the three Henrys, starting with Richard II's successor, or perhaps usurper is a better description, Henry Bolingbroke, Henry IV. Not everyone believes Henry is entitled to be king, particularly the French. There's still a secret treaty promising French help should Richard be attacked. Also, Richard was the French king's son-in-law, so it's by no means an easy succession for the House of Lancaster, and its complications will cloud the reigns of all three Henrys.
The beginning of his reign was disturbed by the tolerance and lenity which he showed to the defeated party. He was alike by mood and need a constitutional king. Great words were used at his succession. This honourable realm of England, the most abundant angle of riches in the whole world, said Archbishop Arundel, has been reduced to destruction by the counsels of children and widows. Now God has sent a man, knowing and discreet for governance, who by the aid of God will be governed and counselled by the wise and ancient of his realm.
The king is once again to govern, but in turn he is to be governed by the wise and ancient council of his realm. Parliament was to be listened to. Would it be? Had we not heard similar promises at the accessions of previous monarchs? Perhaps the difference now was the strength of the commons.
As each change of power had been attended by capital vengeance upon the vanquished, there arose in the commons a very solid and enduring desire to let the great lords cut each other's throats if they were so minded. Therefore the commons, while acting with vigour, preferred to base themselves upon petition rather than resolution, thus throwing the responsibility definitely upon the most exalted ruling class. During this time, parliamentary power over finance was greatly strengthened. Not only did the estates supply the money by voting the taxes, but they began to follow its expenditure, and to require and to receive accounts from the high officers of the state. Nothing like this had been tolerated by any of the kings before. They had always condemned it as a presumptuous inroad upon their prerogative. These great advances in the polity of England were the characteristics of Lancastrian rule, and followed naturally from the need the House of Lancaster had to buttress its title by public opinion and constitutional authority.
This is all in the late months of 1399. Henry IV may have been king, but Richard II was still alive, a prisoner in Pontefract Castle. And as the general bitterness towards Richard began to wilt, the weakness of Henry's government became more obvious. In January 1400, some of the nobles tried to rise in favour of the imprisoned Richard. They failed. But as long as Richard remained alive, the greater the chance of him becoming a rallying figure. It's generally said that he was starved to death. But one contemporary writer believes that Henry sent one of his knights, Sir Peter Exton, to kill him. Even then, it was necessary to display Richard's body at St. Paul's Cathedral to convince the people that he was really dead. Henry was now faced with the demands from the church to set about what were seen as the excesses of the Lollards. The Lollards, they got their name from a medieval Dutch word meaning mutter, as in praying, were religious reformers, followers of the late John Wycliffe. They attacked the Roman belief of the physical changing of the wine and bread into the blood and body of Christ, and what they believed to be the excesses of the clergy. In particular, Wycliffe had translated the Bible into English. He said that everyone who wanted to read the Testaments should be able to. The simplest way to deal with the Lollards, said the church, was officially to declare them heretics. And so, in 1401, there was published a statute of enormous significance. It's called De Heretico Comburendo, and it was written to deal with what its draftsmen called the innovations and excesses of the Lollards. De Heretico Comburendo is the statute which makes it legal in England to take anyone convicted of heresy and burn him or her at the stake.
with regard to which innovations and excesses the prelates and clergy, and also the commons of the realm assembled in Parliament, prayed the Lord King that His Royal Highness would deign to make provision in the said Parliament for suitable remedy. The Lord King granted, ordained, and established that none within the realm presumed to preach unless the license of the bishop of the diocese had been first asked for and obtained. Nor shall anyone preach, hold, teach, or instruct, either openly or in private, or make or write a book contrary to the Catholic faith or the determination of the Holy Church. And if any person refuses to abjure his heresy, so that according to the holy canons he ought to be handed over to the secular court, then the sheriff shall be personally present to carry out such sentence. He shall receive the said persons, all of them, after such sentence has been promulgated, and cause them to be burned in a high place, so that such punishment may strike with fear the minds of others. And by this, no such wicked doctrine and heretical and erroneous opinions shall be sustained or in any way suffered.
In 1401, the burning began. It would seem that Henry supported the statute only partly from his religious orthodoxy, although he did take part in the burning of John Badby in 1410. However, the greater pressure was political. Arundel had been and remained an ally. Debts for friendship were still being paid. The other point to remember here is that the court that would decide in cases of heresy was not civil but ecclesiastical. Later, it would be seen by some as an infringement of the commons' rights. But the act was set. The deeds were done. But now, other bonfires were lit throughout the realm, first in Scotland. Richard II had been almost constantly at war with the Scots. In 1385, Richard had skirmished as far north as Perth and Dundee. In 1338, there had been a crushing defeat for the English on the road between Newcastle and Jedburgh at the Battle of Otterburn. The Scots, led by the Earl of Douglas, had destroyed the English force and captured young Hotspur, the young Henry Percy. Now, war with Scotland became for Henry a more sinister prospect, with the renewal of the Scottish alliance with France. Charles VI of France was probably an imbecile now. France was dominated by Louis of Orléans. Louis was the uncle of Isabella. Isabella was the widow of the murdered Richard II. Henry advanced north as far as Edinburgh, and then had to return south. The Welsh were on the move. Adam of Usk has left us this chronicle of the autumn of 1401.
Owen Glyndŵr, all North Wales and Cardigan and Powys siding with him, sorely harried with fire and sword the English who dwelt in those parts and their towns. Wherefore the English, invading those parts with a strong power, and utterly laying them waste and ravaging them with fire, famine, and sword, left them a desert, not even sparing children or churches or the monastery of Strata Florida, wherein the king himself was being lodged, and the church of which and its choir, even up to the high altar, they used as a stable and pillaged even the patterns. And they carried away into England more than 1,000 small children of both sexes to be their servants. Yet the same Owen did no small hurt to the English, slaying many of them, and carrying off the arms, horses, and the tents of the king's eldest son, the Prince of Wales, which he bore away for his own use to the mountain fastness of Snowdon. On the day of St. Alban, a hard battle was fought between the English under Sir Edmund Mortimer and the Welsh under Owen Glyndŵr, with woeful slaughter even to 8,000 souls. The victory being with Owen.
Edmund Mortimer was captured at that battle. It was thought that he joined forces with the Welsh, that he even married a daughter of Glendower.
But Henry's most serious conflict was with the Percys. These lords of the northern marches, the old Earl of Northumberland and his fiery son Hotspur, had for nearly 3 years carried on the defence of England against the Scots unaided and almost entirely at their own expense. They could no longer bear the burden. The king, in bitter poverty, could offer but £40,000. The Percys had played a great part in placing Henry on the throne, but Edmund Mortimer, Hotspur's brother-in-law, had joined Glendower in rebellion, and the family were now under suspicion. Hotspur raised the standard of revolt. But at Shrewsbury, on July the 21st, 1403, Henry overcame him and slew him. The old earl, who was marching to his aid, was forced to submit, and pardon was freely extended to him. But 2 years later, with his son's death at heart, he rebelled again, and this time the conspiracy was far-reaching. Archbishop Scroop of York and Thomas Mowbray, Earl of Nottingham, were his principal confederates. Once again, Henry marched north. Northumberland was driven across the border. Scroop and Mowbray were beheaded after a summary trial. Scroop's execution caused a profound shock throughout the land, and many compared it with the murder of Thomas Becket.
Now, you would have thought that the church would have reacted with its greatest force, even excommunication. It didn't. Why? The answer is probably because there were two popes. The schism of the church had left a pope in Rome and a pope in Avignon. The English king supported the Roman pope. If he punished Henry, Henry might defect to Avignon, although given England's relations with France, this was not very likely. Yet, although the church protested, Henry remained its child. By 1408, the Earl of Northumberland was dead, killed at Bramham Moor, and Henry's England was free from uprising, if not from malcontents. But the king was ill.
In that same year, 1413, an agreement was made between Prince Henry, first-born son of the king, Henry, Bishop of Winchester, and almost all the lords of England, that they should ask the king to give up the crown of England and permit his first-born to be crowned, because he was so horribly afflicted with leprosy. When this advice was given, he was unwilling to agree to this counsel, but at once rode on horseback through a great part of England, notwithstanding the leprosy. And returning to London, he died at Westminster in the abbot's lodging in a certain low chamber called the Jerusalem Chamber, about the feast of St. Cuthbert.
Henry died of leprosy? Perhaps. Exhaustion? A weak heart? Probably. Whatever. He left a country lacking unity and woefully in debt, and therefore dependent on the goodwill of its magnates, and thus in danger of, rather than a beneficiary of, their mercy. The new king, a young man of 25, bounded to the throne and almost immediately led his country towards the one thing that would bring order and even unity: war with France. Henry V and his archers were on the road to Agincourt.